Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And joining us for the roundtable today is Marty Schladen, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Welcome back, Marty.
Good morning, Amy.
And Jake Zuckerman, reporter for Signal Ohio. Welcome back, Jake.
Thanks for having me on.
And Danny Eldridge, reporter for the Hannah News Service. Welcome back, Danny.
Good to be here.
And I wanted to catch up on some news that happened last week. The chip maker, Intel, made news with a recent announcement that it would slow down construction at its Central Ohio facility, a $28 billion project that has already been pushed back from its opening, which originally was supposed to be this year, to now sometime between 2030 or 2031. The company also canceled plans for plants in Germany and Poland and announced deeper workforce cuts. Marty, you've been watching the Intel project unfold for many years. What exactly does Intel mean by yet another slowdown?
Well, we don't know. As we were talking before we came on the air, Jake was saying that even in their announcement, they said they're closed until further, not further notice. That sounds very vague to me.
Jake, you really enjoyed the use of the word further. So what did you take that to mean when you were listening to the call and they said, we don't know what's going on, we're pushing it further?
Yeah, I mean, I read a lot of uncertainty about it. And if you look at just the macroeconomic conditions now, you know, we still have these high interest rates, tariffs are changing by the day. So if you're just trying to make these really complex decisions, you know, of like, how do I build a $28 billion plan with all kind, you know, I mean, these are chips. They're all these complex processes and heavy industry needed. How on earth are you supposed to understand your costs and where your stuff is going to come from? If today there's a tariff, tomorrow there might not be a tariff, there might be a 50% tariff. It's a really uncertain environment to operate in.
Intel's new CEO said that he is working to put the company on more solid financial footing. And the company sent WOSU a statement last week saying Intel is committed to advancing U.S. technology and manufacturing leadership, and Ohio One remains an important part of our long-term plans to expand leading-edge manufacturing on U.S. soil. So, great words, but no dates, no timeline, nothing in there. Danny, what do you think? Is Ohio One, as he's calling the our Intel project, is it important to them?
I mean, $7 to $8 billion is probably pretty important, I guess. But that's what Governor DeWine keeps saying. Like they've sunk at least that much into this project already, and so it would be, you know, a huge loss if they just stopped construction and didn't do the project. So it seems like they'll probably try to find a way to do something with the with the project. But
well, we're devoting our 10 o'clock show tomorrow to this topic, and we'll be talking about the local ramifications. But I wanted to focus right now a little bit more on the state reaction. You know, all that taxpayer money that's been pumped into the project. Over the years, publicly, Governor DeWine has remained upbeat and positive about the company's commitment to Ohio. Danny, what did he say when he talked about this at the Ohio State Fair? What did the governor say about the Intel slowdown?
I mean, yeah, he said that he talked with the CEO, and he says the CEO remains optimistic, and that, you know, he's not changing his tone on it. He's saying that he's confident that they're going to build chips eventually at the site.
Marty, in your years covering the governor, I mean, would you see him, you know, saying something that wasn't supportive of Intel at this point after we've sunk so much money in?
Exactly. And as Jake wrote back in March, we've given them $600 million in grants that the attorney general says we likely can't get back. I'm trying to do some more. We gave them a big package, you know, and then had the big, you know, groundbreaking and all that sort of thing. So I wouldn't expect the governor to say it's all a bust right now. And I think it all remains to be seen. But something I think that's really interesting is in some of the coverage, I read about how Intel Foundry, which makes the physical chips, and they want customers from non-Intel customers. And it sounds like these customers who also compete with the other wing of Intel are reluctant to do it. And it seems to me that that's perfectly understandable. Why would you allow a vertically integrated competitor to get bigger just so it can swallow you up? I've seen this in the pharmacy benefit manager healthcare marketplace.
In other reaction, Licking County's Commissioner Tim Bubb talked with WOSU's George Shilcock last week, and he did not mince words.
I don't mean to say that somehow that they deliberately pulled the wool over anyone's eyes, but I think they made promises they couldn't keep, and that's okay if it's someone else, but it isn't someone else. In Licking County's case, it's us, and it's Ohio.
Yeah, so Jake, you know, Tim Bubb there, you know, talking about Licking County putting, I mean, they have changed the face of a section of the county in order to build and put the pipes in and do the roads and everything. This is a big deal for them.
Yeah, I'm afraid I'm having a headphone malfunction. I didn't hear the full quote. I remember reading it last week.
Okay.
But I guess what I could say is, you know, of course there's a big problem for locals. If you lay out all this money, at least for right now, you know, you have to consider the possibility that there's never a plant here and all these roadway developments, all this site prep is for nothing, or is for maybe if a company like TSMC takes the project up. But this is all looking much riskier and much more speculative now. I mean, you have to, you know, people's property values are going up. People have moved, you know, like there's just, there was so much of a bet that this would come together, and now I think that there's just at least this specter raising in people's mind that maybe this has all been smoke and mirrors.
And one thing I want to add, too, is in terms of the people around there, I've been told that they were given very little choice. This thing was happening to them, and everybody needed to be on – well, it didn't matter whether you were on board or not. It was happening, and now the whole thing might be going south.
I can't remember if it was Tim Bubb who I talked to. We did another show about Intel a few months ago, and someone that I talked to from the Licking County area said that they were pretty confident that so much had been built that if Intel pulled out, someone else would buy the site. Is that even a possibility? I mean, would someone else, is it built enough that someone else would want it?
I think there were some media reports last year that the Taiwanese semi conducting manufacturer, something close to that. But they were interested in buying it. This was when Intel was kind of churning through CEOs and executives. I don't think there was a whole lot of finality around it. But yeah, I mean, I don't think there are very many companies that compete with Intel here. So it's a very small pool that would need to make a very large purchase.
And there's still all these uncertainties out there while you're asking somebody to make this multi-billion dollar investment, the things that Jake spoke about earlier.
Yeah. Well, and then what about Jobs Ohio? They're the state's private economic development arm, and they really put a lot of sweat equity into this Intel deal. Did they tell the governor to back their own company?
To back their own company? I'm not sure.
Back the wrong company.
Oh, the wrong company.
Did Jobs Ohio make a bad pick with this one?
It's totally possible. I mean, if the whole thing goes south, it's hard to come to a different conclusion.
Well, and you mentioned this before, but Intel was given $600 million in cash. More has been planned. Can the state get any of that money back? Do we know, Jake?
Not to correct Marty, I unfortunately did not write the story about the $600 million in clawbacks, but there's been some public reporting out there that Dave Yost is just uncertain about the clawback provisions here. Like he just seems to read that he doesn't have a ton of power to seize this money back.
Well, I think that for some of the money, I think can be clawed back. I think he's talking about the $600 million was a grant. So I think grants in general are harder to claw back than other types of incentives that you give to companies. So I think that money might just be gone. But that's not the only money the state has given to Intel. And some of that other money may be able to be clawed back.
It's billions.
Yeah.
So if it's a grant, that was like a gift, right? But then if it was an incentive, then they have to have 4,000 jobs by X date, or else they have to give the money back. Something like that. There's rules to it.
It depends on what the language is, and those contracts are all different. And that $600 million grant, I mean, they did promise to do certain things to get that grant, so it is possible they could get some of it back. But I think it's just more difficult.
And I think as a general matter, though, these economic development deals are sort of notorious for not having foolproof provisions so that if there's non-performance, you know, you make these big claims about all the investment and all the jobs are going to be created. When that doesn't happen, I think it's probably more often than not, not all the money gets
returned.
There's
a loophole. Yeah, there's a loophole in the language. Right. This is the Reporter Roundtable on All Sides. We're talking with Danny Eldridge, Statehouse reporter for Hannah News Service, Jake Zuckerman from Signal Ohio, and Marty Schladen with the Ohio Capital Journal. Well, join us tomorrow at 10 for more about Intel, but for now we're going to move on to property taxes. The property tax relief saga continues as the House votes to override just one of the governor's vetoes. Jake, there were three possible vetoes related to property taxes on the table. Why did the House decide to override just one? Did they even try to vote on the others?
Sure. I'd call the one that passed probably the most, the least ambitious of a reach of the three. Not to bore everyone to death here, but it was about something called replacement levies. So if there's a property tax levy in your county, a replacement levy sounds like you will continue to pay the same levy. And what it really is you pay the same rate, but say it's a 10-year levy. Property values have probably risen over those 10 years. So the replacement levy absorbs those property tax increases. So you're paying the same rate on an increased asset. So you're paying more. And there have been Democrats who voted for this in the past. None voted for it this time around. But, you know, there's confusing wordage here. Replacement makes it sound like the same thing. In reality, you're paying more. But some of these were much more ambitious. Some of these would have really limited the amount of money schools can carry over from one year to the next, just limited the way schools can collect property taxes, just to put it very simply. Now, there were four property tax measures that passed in the budget that Governor DeWine vetoed. At first, there was talk about overriding the four, then the list was winnowed down to the three, and only the day of the vote that Matt Huffman called, House Speaker Matt Huffman summoned the whole House in, we learned that there would only be this one vote on this one fairly modest issue. The Senate is saying they have the votes to override it, but this was no overhaul of property tax. Nobody's property tax is going to be immediately adjusted. Your local taxing authority is going to face some new decisions and options as to how to collect revenues in the future, but it's not like we're all getting a big tax cut because of this.
And now, some lawmakers changed plans in order to be there for this vote because it was supposed to be about these three huge property tax things. And as you said, only one, the smallest of the three, passed. There was a lawmaker who canceled a trip to Thailand, a lawmaker who delayed a trip to Italy. That's a lot to ask of your House members, don't you think, to make a change of plans for this? Or is it not a lot to ask? Is that just a part of what you have to do?
I don't know about you. I don't get to Thailand or Italy very often. I would be very cheesed if someone took away my trip to Thailand. You know, I mean, these are public officials. They have a job to do, but this is their summer break. They plan these vacations. The budget passes by July 1. The legislature's back by September. You do what you want in between. Mm-hmm. Next year, they'll have an election to worry about. But so, you know, is it the end of the year that a public official lost their Europe trips? No, but I think that it's a showing of political weakness from the House Speaker. I mean, anyone would be mad in that position, especially that they didn't even get to vote on the big ambitious bill. The bill's passed with 61 votes, so there was actually one vote to spare. So either one of those two people who canceled their trips or delayed their trips would be thinking, God, I could be in Italy right now. I mean, the frustration's palpable.
And I think it's important to note how politically extraordinary a Republican speaker overriding a Republican governor is. Since COVID, we've kind of gotten a little used to that in Ohio, but you know, you're asking these lawmakers to walk a different sort of plank. You know, you're taking on a governor of your own party, the putative leader of the party in the state.
Danny, the Senate is going to have to vote on this same House action, but the Senate didn't return with as much speed or, you know, during the summer recess. Are there plans? Has the Senate President, Rob McCauley, said something about a timetable?
So he hasn't said a specific timetable. I think it's funny. Senate Finance Committee Chair Jerry Serino said, you know, there are people on vacation and some of them are out of the country, so they didn't want to interrupt their trip. So okay. I guess they might have a little bit of a different, tactic there. Senate President McCauley, though, has said on social media that they have the votes to override that veto and they would have the votes to override any of the four property tax vetoes.
But the House has to do it first,
the House
right?
has to do it first yeah. because it is a House bill. The bill
okay, so
this,
even if the Senate has more votes, the House didn't do it, so the Senate just can't
exactly.
do it.
Exactly. The House would, so they, the one veto that was overridden will go to the Senate, and the Senate will likely override that one. And then
at some point, when everyone's back,
whenever they yeah. decide to come back, it could yeah. be right now. I mean, the earliest if needed session is scheduled for September. They could come back whenever, though, if they call a session.
Right. So they could have to come back from Thailand and Italy. Meanwhile, Governor DeWine launched a working group to study property taxes. And here he is telling Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau why this issue is critical.
And the two big goals are we have to get relief to those who really need the relief. And second, we have to continue to be able to support our schools in the state of Ohio. And our fire and our police. We got to do all the above, and we can. We just have to navigate this.
Now, Danny, the governor has faced criticism over making a working group in general, and then he put no legislative leaders on the working group. How has he responded to that?
Well, I mean, he said that he asked House leadership and Senate leadership from the Republicans to be on the panel, and they declined. So I guess they can't really complain about not being on the, you know, the panel if they said they didn't want to be.
You know, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. But when that, after the veto override, I mean, Matt Huffman, at least by my eyes, appeared frustrated after these votes, and he was asked about this working group, and he said, which I think readers could probably empathize with, who cares about another working group? We already had a working group. How many working groups does it take to screw in a light bulb? So he made it, I mean, he made pretty clear that we're not interested.
Marty, property taxes are complicated. Why does this issue stay stagnant? No real movement, no real relief. No one, is it just too hard? No one can figure it out.
I think that's a big part of it. You know, nobody likes taxes in any form, but property taxes are particularly valuable to local government because they're stable. You know, especially if you're in places like Columbus where you've got rapidly increasing property values, it can be hard on, you know, grandma who's got a fixed income, or taxes are going up but her income isn't. But the fact of the matter is, if you're trying to fund a library or a school, you know, one year to the next, you've got a pretty good idea how much money's going to come in the door.
Well, not to mention the decrease in income taxes, it becomes even more difficult to decrease property taxes because that's even less money that's coming into the state.
And that's a great point. Is, you know, your government wants to play Santa Claus and say, hey, you know, we're going to give you this and we're going to give you that. Well, the money's got to come from somewhere.
All right. Well, we're going to leave property taxes there for today. And coming up, Vice President J.D. Vance visits Ohio and Dr. Amy Acton sets a fundraising record for Democratic candidate for governor. That is when the Reporter Roundtable continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk about all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us, Ohio Capital Journal reporter Marty Schladen, Signal Ohio's Jake Zuckerman, and Danny Eldridge, the State House reporter for the Hannah News Service. Vice President J.D. Vance last week visited Canton and touted President Trump's agenda. He talked to union workers about tax breaks for tips and overtime, and he said the federal government is not going to take a dime of that overtime pay. But Marty, the bill's definition of overtime applies a higher threshold for many union workers. So was Vance overpromising here? Can you explain a little bit about what he was talking about versus what the bill actually does?
I think that that's kind of generally true with the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. Vance, the Ohio GOP Senate delegation, are out trying to say that this bill benefits working people. It benefits the middle class. And a lot of observers and the Congressional Budget Office say the bulk of the benefits are going to go to the wealthiest Americans. And, you know, they're trying to spin a counter narrative.
More than 20 unions, including the United Steelworkers, are urging Congress to fix a part of the bill. Does anyone else know anything about what the Jake, no, Danny? Do you know anything more about what the Steelworkers Union is saying?
No, I don't, and I should.
Okay. Well, we'll check in with you next time.
All right.
Now, also in that same speech, Vance spent nearly 2 minutes calling out Ohio Democratic Congresswoman Amelia Sykes for not supporting the budget bill.
You know who we don't have in the House right now? We do not have Congresswoman Amelia Sykes. Amelia, why not work hard with us to make the legislation better? If you disagreed with it, the Oval Office is always open.
So, Jake, Vance is signaling out Sykes. What is the political significance of this? Which, you know, her district is made up of Summit County, most of Stark County, parts of Portage County. What is happening with, like, the Trump administration deciding to single out Amelia Sykes here?
Sure. Well, she's in a very competitive district in a state that doesn't have very many competitive districts. Right now, there are 10 Republicans and 5 Democrats in our congressional delegation. And because of our constitutional rules and a lack of bipartisan agreement, we are going to be drawing new district maps. Mm-hmm. And in all likelihood, Amelia Sykes is going to find herself in a tougher district. There's been some report, you know, Republicans have, through anonymous sources, especially in national media, kind of been mulling, oh, how cruel to be and, like, how aggressive do we want to be in drawing these district maps? But the bottom line is it looks like they're targeting Amelia Sykes, you know, when the vice president comes and starts insulting her, disparaging her on such a national stage. So I think that we should keep an eye on that district, especially because between her, Marcy Kaptur, and Greg Landsman, you know, those were the three who would be on the chopping block. But I think that J.D. Vance is coming and making those comments really makes it clear the target's on her.
And Sykes responded to Vance's comments in an interview with a local TV station. Let's listen.
I'm angry, actually, that he would come to this district and lie and mislead constituents and make it seem as though, one, I didn't do my due diligence when I shared and offered help not once, not twice, but 3 times in committee, offering amendments that were voted down by party lines.
Now, Marty, you know, Ohio is a pretty red state. Do you think that there's national attention on paying attention to Congresswoman Sykes losing her seat?
Definitely, because this is happening in the context of Texas undertaking yet another mid-decade redistricting to try and possibly pick up 5 seats in the House. And now, you know, Democratic leaders are talking about doing something similar in blue states. So the fight is on. And I think that, you know, Ohio, because it's going to have a also a redistricting process, that the Republicans may seek more seats here. Donald Trump told Texas Republicans to undertake this process, which is very controversial.
What is the redistricting update here in Ohio? Have they started drawing the new maps yet? Or when's the deadline? I don't even know.
First deadlines come up this fall around September and October. I think it's September and October if there's bipartisan agreement, and then it stretches into November if, in all likelihood, Democrats do not agree. Actually, I take back in all likelihood. It stretches back into November if Democrats do not agree.
Okay. So they have to draw a new map before and we'll use that map before a primary, right?
Yeah, this will take effect in 2026.
Okay, got it. All right, this is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides. We're talking with Jake Zuckerman from Signal Ohio, Ohio Capital Journal's reporter Marty Schladen, and Danny Eldridge, State House reporter for Hannah News Service. The Ohio Chamber of Commerce PAC has endorsed Vivek Ramaswamy for governor, and the group says this is the earliest they've ever endorsed a candidate. He certainly has momentum on his side and millions in donations, 9.7 million to be exact, for the first half of 2025, and we're still months away from the primary. But also, on the other side of the ticket, Dr. Amy Acton raised $1.3 million, significantly less than $9 million, but $1.3 million as a Democratic gubernatorial candidate. So, Marty, what do fundraising amounts tell us at this point for the governor's race?
Well, certainly that imbalance says that there are a lot of people who think that Ramaswamy is going to be the person. But the fact that Acton raised that much money is surprising to me. It shows that there's some passion on the other side. I'd be interested in knowing what the small dollar amounts were, you know, mm-hmm. because that's sort of an indication of passion. But, you know, we'll have to see how things develop.
Yeah. And overall, Jake, would you say, I mean, Amy Acton has run a pretty quiet campaign so far, but she kind of stepped into the Epstein file controversy. She had a tweet calling for the release of the Epstein files, and she called for Ramaswamy to say the same thing, to say that they need to be released. And a day after this tweet, her account was suspended for several hours. Do you have any, have you heard any explanation about that?
No, her account came back. I mean, this is just kind of noise on a campaign and the reality of living in a world where the world's richest man owns a social media platform used by like 70 million Americans and is very involved in politics, and that clearly bleeds over into this kinds of stuff. No, it's a social media thing. I tune that out.
All right, Danny, what's your take on Amy Acton's campaign? Has she been relatively quiet thus far, or just flying a little bit under the radar?
I mean, she has been, you know, relatively quiet, but I mean, I guess she says that, you know, 1.35 million at this point in the race is a record for a Democratic challenger for governor. So, yes, it's significantly less than Vivek Ramaswamy,
yeah.
But, you know, the Democratic challenger was always going to have a significant cash disadvantage in this race. So, I mean, she's going to have to find other ways to reach voters. And I think she did, to Marty's point, I think she did point out that there were a lot of small dollar donations. So, you know, we'll see how it goes. And we'll also see, you know, who else, if anyone else decides to jump in the race on the Democratic side.
I would say also, though, if she's jumping into the Epstein thing, she's trying to not fly under the radar, mm-hmm. you know?
Maybe she was happy that her account was suspended then. She was like, hey, look, I did so. Yeah.
Another news cycle.
So speaking of someone else jumping into the race, as Danny said, Sherrod Brown, the will he, won't he situation. Will he run for governor? Will he run for the Senate? Will he do nothing? The rumor is that Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer apparently made a second visit to Columbus to meet with Brown. Do we know if that means anything?
Well, I mean, he's a busy guy. Schumer is. Mm-hmm. So that tells me he's putting the arm on Brown to get into that Senate race. You know, he's already proven that he can win. There are those who say that, you know, he also was very fortunate in his opponents in some of these races. But it sounds to me like Schumer's really pressing Brown to get back in.
I don't think Schumer's coming here to ask him to run for governor of Ohio, though, right?
So exactly. He wants to be Senate Majority Leader again.
Yes. So he wants Sherrod Brown back running for that Senate race. Meanwhile, there's a chunk of Democrats here in Ohio that want him to run for governor, I would say. Don't you think so, Jake?
Yeah, there probably are. I think a lot of Democrats just still see Sherrod as this titan, you know, like one of the only Democrats who can win on a statewide basis in mm-hmm. Ohio. You know, obviously he won, let's see, 2018, 2012, 2006. He won in 2006. You know, Republicans say that those were weaker candidates. Two of those races were Jim Renacci. I don't know. You know, it feels like that was a very long time ago. I mean, that was like 9 political lifetimes ago. Some of those races, it's a different politics. These races look different. The amount of money spent on them is unfathomably different.
As a good friend of mine always says, I've slept since then, and everything's different, right?
Right. And there's also, especially with the Joe Biden experience, I think there's a feeling among Democrats that there need to be new faces. There need to be a younger generation rise up.
All right. Well, I wanted to pivot a little bit to some reporting that each of you have been doing. And Jake, you recently took a deep dive into finding out why electric bills keep climbing. Tell us what you found.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost a short answer. It's these data centers. You know, these are the things that power AI, cryptocurrency in the world. They're probably the biggest hub is in Virginia outside of D.C., but among the biggest hubs of data centers is right here in central Ohio. It's hard to comprehend how much power these things use. I mean, for about a decade, our power demand in the region was completely flat. You know, more people are coming onto the grid, but the grid becomes more efficient, so we haven't needed new generation. And all of a sudden, I mean, I think there are 180-some data centers in Ohio now, and they all sited here very recently. And AEP, their utility in the region, is expecting that we're going to use as much power as Midtown Manhattan. I mean, it's a really unbelievable amount of energy. Ohio is subsidizing these data centers at the state and local level. So we're attracting them to come here, and now there are all these risks about A, they're overloading our grid, and B, they're overloading our capacity to supply the grid, and B, someone's going to have to pay for the grid. You know, like, they're electricity runs like highways. Like, there are only so many cars that can fit on the highway at one time, so you might have to expand the highway. If you have to expand the highway, these are multi-billion dollar investments. Who's going to pay? Are the ratepayers going to pay? Are the companies going to pay? Is the utility going to pay? You know, there's just no one wants to be stuck holding the bag here. And so what I wrote about is that our grid is saying that the data centers are to blame and the retirement of coal-fired power plants. Over on the left, some of the environmental groups are saying one of the big powers is that the grid is not moving fast enough to get these renewables, solar, wind online. But all this is just stacking up on our power bills. Power bills have gone up $30 over the past 10 years in Ohio on average per month. And most of those gains were really over the past 3-4 years, which is roughly when the data center boom happened.
Mm. And I think that reporting of yours shows that not only is the state subsidizing these data centers in the form of the sales taxes and all breaks that they get, but we, the ratepayers, are subsidizing them in the form of these higher costs. You know, it would seem to me to be the more direct economic arrangement. If they're the ones putting all this extra demand on the system so that the system needs to be expanded, they should be the ones to pay for it.
Now, recently, the PUCO, Public Utilities Commission of Ohio, changed some rules so that the data centers have to pay more for their own usage rather than, like, I can't remember exactly what it was. Do you know,
sure,
Jay?
The PUCO stepped in, and advocates would say they really stepped in on the side of ratepayers, because there's a lot of risk here. There are a lot of these costs coming down the line and lack of certainty about who's going to pay them. And what the PUCO did is basically pinned these costs on the data centers. Mm-hmm. If you are going to build a data center that requires expanding that highway we talked about, you, the data center, the customer that is paying for this load and demanding this increased load, is going to be the one holding the bag here. And I'd add here that the Republicans in the legislature, I believe it was the Senate that introduced the amendment, they tried to get rid of a pretty significant state sales tax credit, about $130 million a year, that data center builders get to write off of their sales taxes. So pretty significant state investment. Governor DeWine vetoed that. He said that we need these data centers. We like this investment that they're bringing. They spend billions to come here. They usually pay labor, you know, pay unions to build them. We like that here. Now, Matt Huffman, after those votes didn't go his way the other day, said we are considering a veto override. He's since made a similar statement, you know, not we're going to override it on this date at this time, but we're thinking about it. So I'd put it somewhere short of a specific plan, but he's publicly emphasizing that they're going to do it.
Now, it is, I mean, there are jobs when they build the data center, but then after it's built, there's not very many jobs. It doesn't take, like, hundreds of people to run these things.
Yeah, you're correct. They're huge upfront investments. They bring in, I think usually you see numbers like 1,100, 1,400 construction jobs up front. But once they're built, yeah, usually 10 to 50 jobs. And we know that because they apply for these job creation tax credits. And usually when you see companies getting these tax credits, they're going from, like, couple hundred to 1,000 jobs. In the data centers, it's like 10 to 50 jobs. I mean, it's just
like 10 people keeping the center running and security.
Yeah, security, some engineers. I have heard that there's a process where I think the electronics decay in different ways inside, so you got to strip them out every couple of years and put in a bunch of new inputs. So there's some more, you know, I mean, it's not so linear that there are just only 10 to 50 jobs, but these are really not big job factories. They're just giant hard drives, really.
All right. The giant hard drives that suck all the power, right? All right. Well, coming up, we are going to talk about the expanded sales tax credit holiday and how things went at the unclaimed funds booth at the Ohio State Fair. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. And now for some good news in taxes. Ohio's sales tax holiday is underway, and it's running through August 14th. It was expanded from 10 days last year to 2 full weeks this year. We're talking about it on our weekly reporter roundtable from All Sides. And with me in the studio, we have Danny Eldridge, Statehouse reporter for Hannah News Service, Jake Zuckerman from Signal Ohio, and Ohio Capital Journal reporter Marty Schladen. So they keep expanding, Marty, this sales tax holiday. I can remember when it was just one weekend, so now it's 2 full weeks. Do you know why they keep making it longer and longer?
Well, I'm sure it's pretty popular. You know,
yeah.
People don't love paying taxes. They never have. Embarrassingly, I don't know the answers to these two questions. But the things I'd like to know is what sort of hit does that make to state revenue? You know, mm-hmm. the bills have to be paid one way or another. Is this a good trade-off? And the other way to evaluate that is what sort of economic stimulus does it provide?
Yeah, so most items, $500 or less, are included. So school supplies, clothing, electronics. Do we know any other things that are covered? Have you gone out and bought something random because there's no sales tax, Jake?
No, I haven't. And my recollection, I remember covering this issue last year. There was not a noticeable uptick in consumer spending because of the sales tax holiday. So it's not like, you know, everyone's got this written in their calendar. I'm sure there's some savvy shoppers out there who have put this in their calendar, but it doesn't seem to be happening at the state. The macroeconomic level.
Now, the Ohio State Fair wrapped up yesterday, and it was a chance, per tradition, for politicians to do some glad handing. And Governor Mike DeWine, his wife Fran, Lieutenant Governor Jim Tressel were all there. There's lots of renovations happening at the fair. But Danny, the fair was also a chance for Ohioans to get some help collecting their unclaimed funds. A hot topic at the fair was that there was an unclaimed funds booth. This is following the news that unclaimed funds money will be used to help build the Cleveland Browns a new stadium. So can you tell me a little bit about this fair, this booth at the fair?
So, yeah. So they've actually been doing this for a couple years. And it's been pretty popular. So I figured it would be even more popular now that more people are aware of their unclaimed funds and the fact that they may go to the Cleveland Browns if they don't claim them.
Yeah.
So, I went on the first day, on opening day, and, you know, it's just the person running the booth, I'm sorry, I don't remember her name off the top of my head, said that there was a pretty normal number of people at that point. But, you know, basically people go in, they help them find their unclaimed funds. They have two computers there, and then the next steps are to provide documentation and, eventually get hopefully for the people claiming to get the funds that they are owed. But they can't do that at the booth. That's just for finding it.
I had no idea that they had this booth previously. I would have to think it was much more popular this year.
I'm going to follow up with them and see. But she said the traffic at their website is up, she said, 80% since the budget passed. So a lot of people are aware of their unclaimed funds and a lot more people, at least, than were prior to the budget passing.
I looked, and sadly, I do not have any. Did anyone here have any?
I actually did.
Did you get it?
I actually got lucky. I had a few, and I didn't really have to provide any follow-up documentation. I got approved, so it could be that easy. It could be like 5 or 10 minutes. It's not that easy for everybody. Some people, it's very difficult, as I just want to say. I was one of the lucky ones, I guess.
You guys have any unclaimed funds?
I'm an Illinois native. I got like my $90 lifeguarding check from when I was 16 years old from the great state of Illinois. So,
did this prompt you to check in Illinois?
This
is that
absolutely
why?
Prompted me to check. Okay. There is something beautiful about the concept. If you're upset about the Brown Stadium, that you're just so mad about it, and you look on the internet and just get free money from the government because, of, like, if every time you were mad about an issue, you can just hit a button and get $65, that'd be cool.
I wonder, and if there's any professional polling firm out there listening, I'd like to know how popular this stadium deal with the billionaire Haslam family. I'd like to know how popular that is with Ohioans. I have a feeling that it's underwater.
Well, as the resident Steelers fan at the table, I'm not happy about it, but, you know, I'll keep that to myself. Jake, you had a story out this morning about the village of Cadiz. Is that right?
Cadiz.
Okay. In eastern Ohio. I've driven past it so many times, I didn't know. So Cadiz. All right. Officials there have detected high rates of, is it turbidity?
Turbidity.
See, I can't say anything today. Oh, my goodness. Why don't I just say, you tell me what's happening in this town in Ohio.
Sure. So in late June, the city began putting out a boil water advisory warning of turbidity in the water. So it's just a fancy word for dirt kicked up in the water, which isn't dangerous in itself, but dirt can host all, you know, bacteria, different stuff that you don't want your water, you don't want consumed, you don't want your pets to consume it. So
this is a village kind of near Cambridge, near Salt Fork State Park,
near
right?
Salt Fork State Park. It's right on Tappan Lake, if people know it, by the Pennsylvania border. This is in the kind of Roland, Appalachian area.
Mm-hmm.
It's really pretty if you've never been out there. But imagine just more than a month with no clean water. I mean, I've talked to residents. You know, some people are just kind of white-knuckling through it and taking showers and hoping they're okay. People are – the town is distributing. They have a water truck parked in front. They're handing out water bottles. They're trying to get them to seniors. People are getting their kids, you know, school comes back in a couple weeks. No one's exactly sure how that's going to work. People are shuttling their kids to the in-laws a few miles out of town to shower. So it's just kind of a mess.
So what caused it?
There are different interpretations. For one, the city thinks that a bad filter might have something to do with it. And they just, at an emergency meeting, spent $150,000 on new filters. They're going to test those out. It takes a few days for this, you know, the whole system to kind of flush itself out and see if it's producing clean water. They think the droughts last summer, plus these violent rains we've been getting this summer, where you get, you know, heavy couple inches of rainfall in 20 minutes, are just overwhelming the system. So they've emphasized it's really just a process of deduction. You know, you figure out what it isn't on the way to getting to what it is, and they're hoping they figured out what it is. But there's not even a lot of certainty there. The mayor won't give some, we will have clean water by Friday. He's not making that declaration because he knows he'll be cooked if he says you'll have clean water after all these weeks of not having clean water.
How long did you say it's been going on?
I believe June 27 was the first boil water advisory. So,
wow.
Yeah. And if you look, I mean, this water looks gross. You know, there's a picture in the story of a tub filled with brown water. Someone sent me a picture of their water filter. After 5 days of use, it is just caked in mud. It's gross.
All right. Well, we'll have to keep updated on that to see if they get it fixed. Danny, I wanted to turn to a story that you wrote. It is about the Ohio High School Athletic Association has given the green light for a championship event for girls flag football. This is for the spring of 2026. So this is basically sanctioning girls flag football as an official high school sport, right?
Yeah. So they made that announcement. I think it was at the Pro Football Hall of Fame. They had a big event there for girls flag football. That was, a lot of it was aired on ESPN, or at least ESPN affiliated stations and streaming platforms. But so girls flag football has been growing over the years. I guess there was 20 schools 3 years ago, and now there's about 80. So I think, you know, and they expect that number to continue going up. So it is going to have, you know, an official championship in Ohio in 2026.
And the Cleveland Browns are very connected with this, right?
They are. They're on this Ohio High School Football Coaches Association board or something. And I think they're one of the only, if not the only, pro team that's on one of those panels. And they were heavily involved in that. And Jimmy and Dee Haslam, the owners of the Browns, are quoted in the OSHA press release and everything. So they, I think, played a role in that.
Yeah, I did a show several months ago about women's sports and talked about the growth of flag football. And at the time, I talked to two people who coach a team outside of Cleveland that's sponsored by the Browns, and they were really hoping to be a sanctioned sport, but they didn't know when it would happen. So I guess they didn't have to wait too long.
No, they did. I wasn't necessarily expecting it to happen this year when I had talked to their, you know, their spokesperson, but you know, they were apparently ready.
All right. Well, I'm sure it'll just continue to expand. This is the Reporter Roundtable on All Sides. We're talking with Danny Eldridge, State House reporter for Hannah News Service, Jake Zuckerman from Signal Ohio, and Ohio Capital Journal reporter Marty Schladen. And Marty, I wanted to talk about some reporting you've been doing on President Trump's budget bill and what it means for Ohio. So Trump's so-called One Big Beautiful Bill would, among other things, cut $3.4 trillion to it'll add $3.4 trillion to the deficit, but it slashes Medicaid and leaves more Americans and Ohioans uninsured. Marty, can you walk us through what you learned in terms of the impact for rural and urban hospitals here in the state, those Medicaid cuts?
So I learned that the place that this is going to be felt the most is in the emergency room. The American College of Emergency Physicians, the head of their chapter here in Ohio, told me that the federal law requires people to treat all comers, you know, regardless of their ability to pay. They're not going to let you bleed out on the hospital steps. And as these Medicaid work requirements begin to phase in at the beginning of 2027, that's where most of this $1 trillion that's coming out of Medicaid will be saved, according to KFF. And so what that means for the emergency room is they still have to treat all comers, but people aren't going to stop getting sick and injured. In fact, some people, when they lose primary care, are going to show up in the emergency room sicker, and that's going to create increase this burden of uninsured patients by a lot, you know, like 10 million nationally, about 440,000 in Ohio. And what that's going to do in the emergency room is increase wait times before you get treated, increase what they call boarding times when they, you know, after they treat you or stabilize you and want to admit you to the hospital, but there's no bed in the appropriate department, the ICU or whatever. Some people even now have boarding times that are 24 hours long and longer. They say that those are just going to get longer. And hospitals are going to have to look elsewhere to save money to deal with all these, you know, uncompensated care burdens that are added. So the point is, taking $1 trillion out of the healthcare system, is the blast radius is going to be wider than just people who are on Medicaid.
But this is going to be down the line. Like, we're not going to see these impacts tomorrow, right? The money is for later.
Well, so most of the cuts, the way they're budgeted, are loaded into the end of the 10-year span of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. But most of the savings are to come from work requirements, increased work requirements that recipients say it's, well, most people who are on like the Medicaid expansion have jobs as it is, you know, and the vast majority either have jobs or they have, you know, care responsibilities. They have reasons for not working. When this was tried in Arkansas in 2018, it increased the number of uninsured. It did not increase employment levels. Mm-hmm. And these are all things that are well known. Those work requirements under the One Big Beautiful Bill Act take effect at the beginning of 2027, not coincidentally after the midterms.
Okay. And our senators, John Husted and Bernie Moreno, they've been talking about how they restored supplemental funding for rural hospitals. So what did they do? They changed some numbers in the bill?
What they did, and I think this originated with Susan Collins and some others who weren't comfortable with the bill, it added back in $50 billion nationally for to support rural health care. Husted and Marino are saying that's going to result in $1.3 billion in Ohio. KFF says the details are too fuzzy to say that at this point. But that comes in the context of losing, you know, that $50 billion comes in the context of losing multiples more of that. And I've tried to get the Senate offices to talk about whether on a net basis, isn't Ohio actually losing many more billion dollars than they're gaining, and the Senate offices won't respond to my questions.
Well, it depends on how you do the math, right? I guess.
Well, but at the end of the day, math is math. Yeah. Either, you know, if I give you $100 but take away $1,000, you know, you're losing $900.
All right, we have a couple minutes left, and Danny, you covered Governor DeWine has called for the Ohio Casino Control Commission to ban prop bets in sports gambling. So prop bets are like tiny bets, right? Over like on one pitch, or can you?
Well, it can be. I mean, that's what he's. Those are, I guess, what he called micro bets.
Okay,
but a prop bet though is larger than that. That's it could be something that goes over the entire game. You know. Say bet on a quarterback to throw for 300 yards. That's a prop bet.
Okay, so these bets, this is like not betting on the final score of the game or who wins, who loses. This
right.
is bets on different parts of the
it's
game.
It's bet on a statistical achievement that will occur during the game, either by a specific player or by a team.
And he and Governor DeWine wants to ban these?
That's what he's saying. He wants to ban all prop bets. But he's been talking more about the micro prop bets. So I don't know if he's – so I kind of want to clarify if he wants to ban a certain type of prop bet or if he wants to ban all prop bets. He did say he wants to ban all prop bets. So don't. But he talks more about the micro prop bets as being the problem.
And this is kind of based on two Cleveland Guardians pitchers who got in trouble.
Yes. Yes, I know Emmanuel Clase was one of them, and then
Ortiz,
yes, Luis Ortiz, yes. So they're both under investigation for sports betting related investigation. So some of their pitches looked a little questionable in some of these.
So
games,
that's whenever he bet on whether the first pitch of the game would be a ball, and it clearly was a ball. Yeah,
it's possible that,
or
that
he didn't bet, a friend of his bet. Or something like that. I don't know.
That could be. I think that's what they're looking into. Is there were some questionable things going on the video, and then I think some questionable betting.
Well, let's not get too deep into the sportsing right now. Okay, we'll save prop betting for another time. This has been the Reporter Roundtable on All Sides. We've been talking with Danny Eldred, State House reporter for the Hanna News Service. Thank you, Danny.
Thanks for having me.
Jake Zuckerman from Signal Ohio. Thanks, Jake.
Thanks for having me on.
And Ohio Capital Journal reporter Marty Schladen. Thanks, Marty.
Thank you, Amy.
And to end the show today, I wanted to take a moment to say thank you to two Ohio State students who have been working for All Sides for a long time. David Stein has been with us for almost 2 years. Chris Corcoran has been with All Sides for 3 years. They started as interns, but both became great producers for this show, and we truly could not have done many, many shows without them. We wish them good luck in their future adventures. Both have graduated from Ohio State and are now moving on to the next steps in their careers. Chris and David, thank you both. Good luck, and we'll miss you. This has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.